They say more attention should be given to marketing, better packaging and transportation to boost agricultural exports. The Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines and Agriculture also released a report examining the relative decline in agricultural products. The report showed a less than average rainfall coupled with misuse of natural resources in farming practices are two of the major culprits of reduced production. Mining is the process of extracting valuable materials from the Earth's crust. It is one of the oldest industries and dates back to prehistoric times when people first mined flint to make tools and weapons. However, mining has come a long way from its traditional methods to incorporate advanced material science and geology. Moreover, modern mining wouldn't be the same without its heavy-duty machines to extract and haul material for processing. On the whole, this sector is one of the largest and most productive industries the world has ever known.
We are going to take a look at Iran's mining industry while shining the spotlight on zinc dust production. We wanted to see how this stuff is made and where it's used. Plus, we will explore this sector's contributions to the national economy.
To better understand the most recent developments in the mining industry, we visited Zarin Rui Caspian. It is a subsidiary of the parent company Zarin Industrial Mining Group and specializes in making zinc dust. Products at this company come in the form of bluish-gray zinc powder or granules. These products are made with specific formulations depending on their end use. In short, these items are produced when purified zinc vapors are condensed. But this requires a large amount of processing, starting with melting zinc crucibles. Next, the molten zinc is transferred to a vaporizing furnace. The vapors are then sent to a condenser to form zinc dust by circulating the gas through a cyclone cooler. Most zinc dust production plants include a vertical crucible melting and vaporizing furnace and a condenser, which operate on a fluid and continuous basis. That's why this production company works around the clock without breaks. Now you might be wondering where zinc powder is used. Due to its unique characteristics, it is a sacrificing element that helps prevent corrosion, meaning it works well in absorbing moisture and strengthening metal surfaces against oxidation. It is a perfect substance for coating industrial machines that withstand harsh climatic conditions.
So many processes are at work when it comes to mining. There is exploration, extraction, and refining of raw material, just to name a few. But activities don't end there. Usually, there are mega holding companies in the mining sector with several subsidiaries, such as the company we just mentioned. These subsidiaries are essential in expanding and completing mining-based products' supply chains.
An asset to corporations is their research and development departments. This is because they carry out activities leading to technological development. That is to say, they develop new services or products and improve existing ones while elevating the company's industrial standing. This department also performs critical quality control checks where standards are also implemented. And indeed, standards are everything, especially for foreign trade. One of this company's competitive advantages is its high purity products based on national and international needs. This company also purchases most of its raw materials from domestic suppliers. Among its services, it can formulate zinc powders based on special orders from customers. It also provides its customers flexible delivery, whether by sea, air, or ground. This producer has never stopped looking to the future. It plans to increase its current market share and create new products that can be used in other down-the-line industries. This company has achieved many successes despite being relatively recently established. But that's not to say it has not faced many challenges along the way. One such challenge has been maintaining its machines, which sometimes require spare parts for repairs.
Well, I'm going to go into a several-minute silence because my good friend and colleague is out there on the field to give you guys a wonderful report. Take it away.
In a world grappling with coronavirus, a significant number of health-related companies have been looking for a solution to contain the spread of the virus. With the development of various testing methods, there has been a huge spike in demand for the virus sampling kits, and especially the sampling swabs.
God, I'm just so very tired of wearing masks. But what can I say? Ever since the pandemic took the world by storm, our life has changed in an unpredictable way. One of the prominent changes is the development of sampling technology to meet the evolving need of COVID-19 testing. Today, we came to Damahi Biotechnology Company to see how the sampling swabs that we see everywhere are produced. So don't go anywhere, stay with me.
At the start of the outbreak, most of the sampling swabs were imported into the country and the domestic supply chain had been inconsistent. For this reason, this Iranian company in biotechnology decided to take steps towards promoting local sampling swabs on a large scale. When it comes to production, the swabs are produced in two different forms: oral swabs and nasal swabs. Anyway, let's take a look at the production line.
All right, the production process of the sampling swabs begins in this unit. At this stage, after the plastic handles are imported into this factory, they go through the swab flocking machine to form the header. Actually, when I look at it, it kind of looks like the ear cleaning swabs that we use on a day-to-day basis. But in fact, they are completely different. These headers are actually made of fibers, so it's totally something else. When the swabs are produced, they get to this stage for quality control and cleaning before they get to the packing hall. And finally, they pass through the sealer machine for pressing. But I should mention that the swabs are not finalized at this stage. They have to go through the sterilization process, and by the end of the day, the sterilized swabs are transported to different laboratories all across the country.
In case you wonder about the head of the swab, unlike how we thought earlier that it looks like the ear cleaning swab, the foam-headed material eliminates the possibility of adhesive residue contamination. So by the end, the sterilized sampling swabs are distributed for field or home testing to meet the growing need of the country.
Even though it looks very simple, the production procedure of the sampling swabs is very complicated. Now, thanks to the development of such diagnostic tools, the world has managed to curb the pandemic in numerous ways. I've been Sarah Adema. Stay safe and bye-bye.
Many thanks for that fantastic adventure. That wraps up our program for today. Thank you so much for tuning in. I have been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next bazaar.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
A new bipartisan opinion poll says two-thirds of U.S. Democrats say President Joe Biden is too old for a second term in office, as the 80-year-old commander-in-chief remains tied with Donald Trump in a potential matchup in 2024. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. CNN Cable News Network has covered this story and tells us more. According to a new opinion poll, more than half of U.S. adults believe President Joe Biden's policies are making the economy worse. The opinion poll released on Thursday, 7th of September, and conducted by SSRS, found 58% of the American public surveyed believe that Joe Biden's policies have worsened economic conditions in the United States, in comparison to 24% who believe his policies improved economic conditions. 18% said the president's policies had no effect on the country's economy. The opinion poll also found that Joe Biden's approval rating dropped to 38%, the lowest point since the opinion poll began surveying his performance in March of 2021. 58% of U.S. adults said they have an unfavorable impression of the president, while 45% said he cares about people like them. Stubborn inflation over the past 2 years and increasing interest rates from the U.S. Federal Reserve have prompted criticism of the Biden administration's economic policies, as voters report feeling little relief at home. The White House has continued in recent weeks to tout President Biden's Bidenomics plan. Recently, the president penned an opinion editorial in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, pointing to increasing wages, rising job satisfaction, and restoring union pensions. Joe Biden also claimed inflation is near its lowest point in over 2 years, in the wake of the first anniversary of the Inflation Reduction Act, a sweeping economic legislation package that aimed to tackle inflation, increase jobs, and decrease unemployment level. According to a CNN survey, over half of Democrats are seriously concerned about Biden's age negatively impacting a variety of factors, including his physical and mental competence and his ability to win the 2024 election. It found 56% of Democrats and 73% of the American public are seriously concerned about Biden's current level of physical and mental competence. About 60% of Democrats expressed concern about his ability to win the 2024 election if he clinches the Democratic nomination. When it comes to his ability to serve a full second term in office, another 62% of Democrats and 76% of the American public said they're seriously concerned. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Almost half of registered voters say any Republican presidential nominee would be better choice than Joe Biden. The survey found that 46% of registered voters said any Republican presidential nominee would be better than Joe Biden in the next year's election, while 32% said the sitting president would be a better choice than any of the GOP hopefuls. In comparison, 44% said that any Democratic nominee would be better than the former president, Donald Trump, while 38% said the former president is better than any Democratic nominee. When asked about a hypothetical matchup between Joe Biden and one of the major Republican candidates, there was no clear leader in most of the opinion polls, except for former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. When matched up against Joe Biden, Nikki Haley led 49% to 43%. no other Republican presidential candidate, including former Vice President Mike Pence, Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy, and former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, or former President Donald Trump, showed more than a 2 percentage point margin in the matchup with Biden. The opinion poll also found that 67% of Democratic and Democratic-leaning voters wished they had an alternative to Joe Biden. The two candidates running against him, author Marianne Williamson and Robert F. Kennedy Jr., both polled at 1%. Declining shares of the Democratic base see him as inspiring confidence, which stands at 51%, down 19 percentage points since last March. Declining numbers of Democrats also see him as having the stamina and the sharpness to serve effectively as president, which is now at 49%, down 14 percentage points since last March. Also, the survey found about 2 in 3 Democratic-aligned voters say they would like to see a different nominee than Joe Biden. 67% of Democratic and Democratic-leaning voters surveyed in the opinion poll said they would like their party to nominate someone other than Joe Biden, which is up from 54% who said the same back in March. Out of those who would like to see a different candidate, 82% said they would prefer any candidate besides the current president. 18% listed a specific alternative to Joe Biden, but just 1% respectively said they would support one of Biden's primary challengers. The opinion poll also found that Democratic support for seeing Biden as inspiring confidence has dropped 19 percentage points since last March and now stands at 51%. Declining numbers of Democratic-aligned voters also see him as having the stamina and sharpness to serve effectively as president, which is now at 49%, down 14 percentage points. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Hill reports that most voters in a new opinion poll believes President Joe Biden was involved in his son's business dealings whilst he was vice president. The opinion poll released on Thursday, 7th of September, and conducted by SSRS, found that 61% of voters believe that Biden had some involvement in Hunter Biden's business dealings, including 42% saying he acted illegally, and 29% who said it was unethical but not illegal. Another 38% believe that President Biden did not have any involvement in Hunter Biden's businesses. The opinion poll also found that more than half of voters believe that President Biden acted inappropriately over the investigation into alleged gun and tax crimes committed by his son, whose plea deal with prosecutors fell apart back in July. The opinion poll was conducted before Special Counsel David Weiss revealed he will seek to indict Hunter Biden before the end of this month in a court filing updating the judge on his investigation into the president's son's failure to pay taxes. President Biden has denied any involvement in his son's business dealings as House Republicans barrel towards a possible impeachment inquiry into the president over issues relating to his family's business dealings. Views about whether President Biden was involved in his son's business are divided among partisan lines. Just 28% of Democrats said he had some involvement in his son's dealings, while 90% of Republicans said he had some involvement, including 76% who said this was illegal. Moreover, the U.S. deficit is projected to roughly double this year, largely due to higher interest rates and lower tax revenues. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, an organization that pushes for lowering the deficit, is projecting the federal deficit will double this year to total about $2 trillion for the fiscal year that ends on 30th of September.
The wildfires in Greece Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Former head of Israel's Mossad spy agency has said the occupying entity enforces an apartheid system against Palestinians. The admission has been made by Tamir Pardo, who was the regime's spy master from 2011 to 2016.
Let's say there is a car accident between a car of a Jewish settler and a car of a Palestinian who lives in Hebron or Nablus. Each one of them stands before a different legal system, one under the military legal system and the other the civilian system. In a territory where two people are judged under two legal systems, that's an apartheid state.
Pardo becomes the latest former senior official to have concluded that Israel's treatment of Palestinians in the West Bank amounts to apartheid. That's a reference to the system of racial separation in South Africa that ended in 1994. Leading rights groups in Israel and abroad, as well as Palestinians, have accused Israeli occupation of the West Bank of morphing into an apartheid system. A handful of former Israeli leaders and diplomats have warned that Israel risks becoming an apartheid regime, but Pardo's language was even more blunt. Israel has been practicing an apartheid system against Palestinians, though far more brutally, since 1948. This is when, with the support of Western governments, Zionist terrorists claimed Palestine to be their homeland. Israel launched another war in 1967, occupying more Palestinian territory, such as the West Bank, including East al-Quds, that Palestinians want as the capital of their future state. Since then, Israeli apartheid authorities have created a judicial system that allows them to steal more Palestinian homes and land and dispossess them in order to make way for more illegal settlers. Rights groups have pointed to the discriminatory policies within Israel and in occupied East al-Quds, its blockade of the Gaza Strip, which has been ruled by the Hamas group since 2007, and its occupation of the West Bank.
Because the U.S. was the last pillar to fall, the last domino to fall in sustaining apartheid in South Africa, where it had to fall in line with everyone else. But during apartheid South Africa and the international campaign against it during that regime's tenure, the United States issued the most vetoes within the Security Council to protect apartheid there, to protect apartheid in Namibia and South Africa. And here we're seeing a similar pattern.
Rocket fire from Gaza. Palestinian fighters carrying out an unprecedented offensive with thousands of rockets. Sirens sounding across Israel, including Tel Aviv and Al-Quds. Israel is being attacked ferociously. This was by far the biggest operation by resistance groups against Israel in decades. We decided to put an end to all the crimes of the occupation. Their time for rampaging without being held accountable is over. We announced Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, and we fired in the first strike of 20 minutes more than 5,000 rockets. That was the announcement by the Ezzedine Al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of the Hamas resistance group. Armed clashes along the separation fence with Israel near the southern town of Khan Yunis were reported to take place. Fighters seen here breaking through the fence. The mood, however, was different. The head of Hamas's political bureau is seen celebrating the operation, carried out not only by Hamas fighters, but by all the resistance fighters in the Gaza Strip. Such was the case at the Jenin refugee camp. Israel has declared a state of war alert, striking back, setting the stage for a new heavy war. Hamas fighters are seen inside an Israeli military camp, which shows the shock surprise of Israeli army. Here, Hamas fighters are seen with a captured Israeli military vehicle. This is a large operation including all Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank, namely Hamas, PFLP, the Ezzedine Al-Qassam Brigades, and the Islamic Jihad movements. In the occupied West Bank, the Lion's Den is also active. Israeli towns are on fire, like Rehovot in southern Israel, and Ashkelon seen burning after resistance rockets landed there. So dire the situation, Israelis were forced to hide in trash bins. Meanwhile, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are looking for cover, while sounding defiant when it comes to Israeli regime forces. Israel is finding itself on shaky grounds, even though it has mobilized reservists. There are shortages since reservists, along with pilots, have refused to take orders due to its so-called judicial reforms, which is why this announcement by Netanyahu may fall on deaf ears. Our enemy will pay a price, the type of which it has never known. That was a statement from Netanyahu. The surprise offensive that Palestinian fighters executed against the Israeli regime is a natural outcome of what Israel has done with Palestinians over the decades. Hezbollah summed it up best. This was a decisive response to Israel's continued occupation. However, Hezbollah also added this to its statement. This is a message to those seeking normalization with Israel. A clear reference to Saudi Arabia, which is said to be in talks with Israel for, quote, normalization. Ever since this extreme cabinet came into power, it has violated Palestinians on a daily basis. Not that previous Israeli officials did not do that, but this cabinet has done it at warp speed, which puts into question why Saudi Arabia would be interested in pursuing a, quote, normalization. Any normalization with Israel would be a stab in the back of Palestinians. Just the other day, Israel announced that it will legitimize the killing of Palestinian citizens in new open fire rules. It said the new measure seeks to allow officers to use live fire against Palestinian protesters. Al-Aqsa violations, Israeli incursions, injuring and killing Palestinians. All of this in the face of the silence by the international community. How much longer could Palestinians endure this?
The war drags on in Ukraine, signs are emerging that do not bode well for the U.S.-led coalition against Russia. Just days ago, the Slovak Social Democracy Party, which is a pro-Russia party, won the country's parliamentary elections. The leftist Smeristy Party, led by former Premier Robert Fico, has not secured enough votes to form a government and needs to form a coalition with other parties. But the victory has been interpreted as a sign of growing war fatigue in Europe. The party's leader has said that no more weapons would go to Ukraine. He has also questioned the logic of the EU's Russia sanctions and even accused NATO of causing the war.
I believe that on the one hand, yes, we should expect a certain, let's say, uncomfortable relationship between Brussels and Slovakia. But then on the other hand, I also think that the relationship will also be rather pragmatic. However, the danger is real when it comes to Slovakia's declining support to Ukraine. And this will also have its impact to weaken the EU's unity when it comes to its support for Ukraine.
Just weeks ago, Poland, a staunch ally of Ukraine, announced that it would no longer supply weapons to its neighbor amid a diplomatic dispute over Kiev's grain exports. Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki has said that Poland's focus was instead on defending itself with more modern weapons. The country's president later tried to modify this stance, but the dispute is seen as a rift among members of the the anti-Moscow alliance. Poland has supplied hundreds of Soviet-era tanks and 14 MiG-29 fighter jets to Ukraine and served as a major transit hub for weapons from other Western nations. These developments have stirred talk of a global shift in sentiment towards supporting Ukraine as the war grinds on, more than a year and a half after it began.
It is full of Ukrainians here. This is what I seriously do not like. They get benefits, energy costs went up, everything went up. So basically, they are getting benefits, and we, our citizens, we pay.
The money spent on the war in Ukraine has unnerved many citizens in European countries. Days ago, hundreds of people staged rallies in different German cities to vent their anger at Berlin's growing support for Ukraine. Many protesters carried banners and placards advocating for peace in Ukraine while expressing opposition to government policies, including the remilitarization of Germany. Demonstrators said Germany's decision to send more weaponry to Ukraine risks escalation of the conflict with Russia. Some protesters demanded that Germany pull out from the NATO alliance. Some said the United States is benefiting from Germany's intervention in the Russia-Ukraine war. Germany is among Western countries that have provided Ukraine with a wide range of weapons since the war erupted in February 2022.
I'm mainly concerned with crisis intervention and resolving this armed conflict on the one hand. On the other hand, of course, there are trends in the militarization of Germany. After all, from a purely political point of view, Germany is right in the middle, and America is shamelessly taking advantage of that too, using citizens through media policy to perhaps ultimately use them for their own goals, and Ukrainian citizens were also exploited.
The German economy has suffered due to crisis in Ukraine. It tipped into a recession at the start of the year and stagnated in the second quarter. High inflation, industrial slowdown, and reduction in global demand for manufactured goods have all been weighing on the German economy. And earlier in October, dozens of anti-war activists in New York City said that the interest of NATO depends on the perpetuation of imperial capital and extraction of wealth from the dispossessed.
Unification of peace forces in the United States, recognizing that it's the United States and NATO who are the to blame and the fundamental cause of the conflict in Ukraine, and that if we can force the U.S. government to stop sending money and weapons to Ukraine, the war will end the very next day.
A poll conducted in August said most Americans oppose Congress authorizing additional funding. Overall, 55% say the U.S. Congress should not authorize additional funding to support Ukraine versus 45% who say Congress should authorize such funding. And 51% say that the U.S. has already done enough to help Ukraine. The removal of Kevin McCarthy as Speaker of the House of Representatives has added to the uncertainty around aid for Ukraine.
Kevin McCarthy has been ousted as Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives in a brutal, historic rebellion by far-right Republicans. The rebellious GOP lawmakers, furious at his cooperation with Democrats, have accused him of a string of broken promises. This is the first ouster of a Speaker in the House's 234-year history.
On this vote, the yeas are 216, the nays are 210. The resolution is adopted. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid on the table. The office of Speaker of the House of the United States House of Representatives is hereby declared vacant.
I mean, it's a sign, I think, if history is any guide at all to this, it's a sign of a party in disintegration. I mean, that's what's happening. And it's melting down, and that's pretty clear. That's the older history. The more recent history, I think, is that what we're seeing today is the latest installment in the, you know, ever continuing coup d'etat by Donald Trump. I mean, that's what we're seeing.
The vote to oust McCarthy marks a major escalation in tensions for a House GOP conference that has been mired in infighting, and it comes just days after McCarthy successfully engineered a last-minute bipartisan effort to avert a government shutdown.
That I think probably the next step would be a shutdown, which is really what they're probably aiming for. They wanted to get McCarthy out of there in part because he stood in the way of that. Bunch of reasons, but that's part of it. And it's the politics of chaos.
The effort to oust the speaker was led by GOP Republican Matt Gaetz. There is also a significant amount of distrust and anger from House Democrats towards McCarthy over his actions as speaker and the House GOP agenda. The rebellious lawmakers accused McCarthy of a flip-flop, saying he had promised an end to hastily prepared stopgap legislation, hammered out with the support of the opposition, and a return to budgeting through the committee process. Some Republican leaders condemned McCarthy's removal, with former Vice President and current presidential candidate Mike Pence suggesting it would undermine the GOP in the eyes of voters. There is no clear successor to oversee the House Republican majority. Congress has just over 40 days to agree on a deal to avoid another potential government shutdown.
But there is a certain nihilistic quality to what they're doing. However, there is also, you know, genius in the madness, because the madness is about creating as much chaos as possible. And then, you know, then the Trump people will step in.
Speaker Kevin McCarthy's ouster could signal a shift in the U.S. House of Representatives on aid to Ukraine, with some of his possible successors staunchly opposed to assisting Kiev. Republican opponents of the aid view it as excessive spending and a misplaced U.S. policy priority.
I rise to put the leadership of the House, the Senate, and the President of the United States on notice. I will not consent to any expedited passage of any spending bill that provides any more American aid to Ukraine. It's as if no one has noticed that we have no extra money to send to Ukraine. Our deficit this year will exceed $1.5 trillion. Borrowing money from China to send it to Ukraine makes no sense. It's not as if we have some sort of rainy day fund sitting around, trillions of dollars in a pot of money, and we're just going to send that to Ukraine. We're going to borrow it. When we borrow it and create new money to pay for that borrowing, we create the inflation that is plaguing our economy.
McCarthy earlier this week denied accusations by Gaetz that he had cut a secret deal with Biden to allow the House to vote on Ukraine aid. McCarthy said then he wanted more information from the Biden administration. President Joe Biden asked Congress in July to approve another $24 billion related to Ukraine. Although the compromise struck in Congress dropped new fundings for Ukraine amid opposition from hardline Republicans, it remains unclear what might happen next. Biden and his Democratic Party say the U.S. has a duty to help Ukraine.
And why it's critically important for the United States and our allies that we keep our commitment. We can support Ukraine in the next tranche that we need, and there is another means by which we may be able to find funding for that, but I'm not going to get into that now.
However, the issue has become so politicized in Washington that the fate of vital military aid is now in jeopardy. The U.S. has approved four rounds of aid to Ukraine, totaling about $113 billion, with some of that money going towards replenishment of U.S. military equipment that was sent to the front lines.
Since the beginning of Russia's war in Ukraine, the American taxpayers provided Ukraine with $113 billion. Over the 583 days of war, between February 24, 2022 and the end of the month, that averages $6.8 billion per month, or $223 million per day. There's a lot of things that we need to fix in our country before we borrow money to try to perpetuate a war in another country.
There are also widespread concerns over corruption in Ukraine. The U.S. is increasingly urging Ukraine to do more to combat corruption. This is while Ukraine considers the direct budget support it gets from the U.S. and other foreign allies to be vital to keeping its economy afloat.
choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The United Kingdom's oil and gas sector regulator is drawing up plans to give companies a greater focus on decarbonisation, given that they are not on track to deliver a commitment to halving their emissions by 2030. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. United Kingdom's oil and gas companies need to do more if they are to meet an official target of halving their emissions from fossil fuel extraction by the end of the decade, according to the North Sea regulator. The North Sea Transition Authority, the NSTA, said it would set out proposals to help give fossil fuel companies a greater focus on their climate pledges, amid concerns that targets would be missed without further action. The firms promised to slash their carbon emissions caused during the production of oil and gas as part of a deal struck with the government in 2021 to secure billions of pounds in state help for the sector. This year, the British government set out plans to grant more than 100 new North Sea exploration licences and gave the green light to develop the huge Rosebank oil field. The North Sea Transition Authority warning is the latest to cast doubt on the United Kingdom's meeting its legally binding climate targets, given government announcements of plans to delay the ban on combustion engines in new vehicles and the phase-out of gas boilers, and to water down home energy efficiency standards. The watchdog's proposals will form part of an industry consultation to encourage oil and gas operators to take action today. The industry is under pressure to reduce carbon emissions from oil and gas production, which accounts for about 3% of total United Kingdom greenhouse gas emissions. Last month, the North Sea Transition Authority report found the industry was on track to meet the interim emissions reduction targets of 10% by 2025 and 25% by 2027, compared with 2018, but added that bold measures will be required to halve carbon emissions by 2030. Significant progress has been made, but there is more work to be done, and the North Sea Transition Authority estimates that without further initiatives, the 2030 emissions reduction target agreed between the government and industry as part of the North Sea Transition Deal may be missed. The government's transition deal earmarked more than £8 billion in public funds to support the industry as it prepared to play a role in the United Kingdom's ambition to develop carbon capture technology and hydrogen production. In exchange, the industry promised to cut its carbon emissions and use British-made components for 50% of their decarbonisation projects. The North Sea Transition Authority said the industry risked losing its ongoing social licence to operate, which allowed companies to keep drilling for oil and gas even while Britain moved away from fossil fuels, unless it could meet its longer-term climate targets. Philip Evans, a climate campaigner for Greenpeace UK, said the industry's operational emissions were the mere tip of the iceberg compared with those produced by using fossil fuels, which accounted for more than 80% of the total emissions from drilling, extracting and burning oil and gas. This is why Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's plan to max out North Sea reserves is a grave mistake, Philip Evans said. The government's deliberate disregard for the majority of the emissions from these climate-wrecking projects is completely reckless, and the reason we're fighting them in two separate courts of law. And unless it revokes the recently approved license for Rosebank, we're likely to be back for a third court case. A British government spokesperson said, through our landmark North Sea transition deal agreed between the British government and industry, we are backing the decarbonisation of the oil and gas sector while supporting tens of thousands of jobs across Scotland and the wider United Kingdom. While our plans to power up Britain include significant investment in new renewable and nuclear projects, the transition to non-fossil forms of energy cannot happen overnight. And even when we are at net zero emissions, we still need some oil and gas, as recognised by the Independent Climate Change Committee. The business media brand, the ED Network and the ED website has also covered the same story and tells us more. The North Sea Transition Authority this week opened a consultation on a forthcoming plan for low-carbon transition for the sector. It has concluded that the industry is on track to reduce carbon emissions by 10% by 2025 and by 25% by 2027. Against the 2018 baseline. However, measures already in train across the sector are unlikely to deliver a promise to halve carbon emissions between 2018 and 2030, by the North Sea Transition Authority's calculations. Significant progress has been made, but there is more work to be done, and the North Sea Transition Authority estimates that without further initiatives, the 2030 emissions reduction target agreed between the government and industry as part of the North Sea Transition Deal may be missed. The statement by the North Sea Transition Authority added, "Bold measures will be needed to deliver the 2030 climate target. Progress is tough and will require investment, collaborative effort, and detailed planning." The North Sea Transition Authority is consulting on measures to reduce the sector's operational emissions across four pillars: energy and material efficiency, switching fuel sources to electric or other low-carbon alternatives, cutting venting and flaring, and managing asset inventory to phase out older, less efficient assets. It bears noting that Scope 3, or indirect emissions from the sector, are not covered in the North Sea Transition Authority's proposed plan. As the bulk of the sector's total carbon footprint is generated from the end use of its fuels, Greenpeace UK has stated that the proposed changes would only address the mere tip of the iceberg. On flaring and venting, Chris Skidmore, MP's Net Zero Review, recommended the implementation of a ban in 2025. The British government declined to adopt this recommendation and said the original 2030 ban date would already be challenging to meet. The North Sea Transition Authority is consulting on interim targets to reduce venting and flaring, creating a more detailed pathway. Already, flaring has been reduced by more than 40% since 2018. In other news from the North Sea's fossil fuel sector, the Crown State has awarded a BP-led carbon capture and storage project with an agreement for lease. The Crown State has stated that the project, called Endurance, has the potential to be one of the largest of its kind in the world. It will enable carbon dioxide to be stored in a reservoir in a rock deep under the ocean. Carbon being stored in the reservoir would predominantly be captured from heavy industrial clusters in the northeast. British Petroleum BP is notably leading the East Coast Cluster project to bring industrial hubs in Humberside and in Teesside to net zero by 2050. Other firms are participating through the Northern Endurance Partnership. The Crown State, which leases plots of seabed, called the awarding of the lease agreement a significant milestone for growing Britain's carbon capture and storage capacity.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this program, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a part of a speech delivered by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the veterans from the Sacred Defense and the Resistance Field. This meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on September 2023, inaugurating Sacred Defense Week. What I would like to say is that the event of the Sacred Defense is a prominent, important period in our country's history. As to what was being defended, the Islamic Revolution, the Islamic Republic, which was the product of defending the Islamic Revolution, and the country's territorial integrity were being defended. These were the three important things that were being defended. The other side had attacked these three things. Of course, the target of the main important part of the front of the enemy, which I will explain later in the second part of my speech, was not the issue of territorial integrity. That was Saddam's goal. Their target was the revolution. They wanted to suppress this unparalleled, great, important revolution that had taken place in Iran thanks to the sacrifices that had been made by the people.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Why do we say it was unparalleled? Because it was a phenomenon that had not taken place before in major revolutions. It was democratic, it was religious, it was authentic, and it was not dependent. It was related to a nation. It was by the people. It was not like coups, revolutions by political parties, or things of that sort. This revolution was able to remove the dependent corrupt system that was ruling the country and establish a new system and a new voice in its place, the Islamic Republic. Republic means democracy. Islamic means religion. Religious democracy was a new term in the world. We have had religious governments throughout history, but there was no talk of democracy in them. We have had democratic governments, real or fictitious, but there was no talk of religion in them. Never before had there been a government or a system in which religion and this world and the hereafter, the people and God were all involved and were the builders of it. But such a thing happened, and they wanted to crush it, overcome it, and eliminate the Islamic Republic.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Sailing towards what they hope will be the last leg of an arduous journey to safety. But those who make it face a hostile environment, thanks to the British government's controversial plan to deport thousands of asylum seekers coming to the UK illegally to the East African country of Rwanda. The plan has a short but checkered history. In June, the UK's Court of Appeal overturned a high court ruling which had said Rwanda was a safe third country for migrants to be sent to. This week, the British government is appealing that ruling here.
Critics say the Rwanda policy pursued by the Interior Ministry risks violating the UK's international obligations to protect human rights. They're raising concerns about the impact of the policy on victims of modern slavery and trafficking, and also on women, children, and disabled people arriving on British shores.
There are concerns about people being prematurely returned to the nations from which they are fleeing in the first instance, when an initial decision may be made. Is there a robust and independent appeal process for those people that would offer them protection whilst their claims are going through the independent tribunal service? There are lots of concerns about this ill-thought-out policy.
But the British Interior Minister Soila Braverman disagrees. Earlier this month, she dialed up her anti-immigration rhetoric in a desperate attempt to appeal to the Conservative Party faithful at their annual conference in Manchester.
The wind of change that carried my own parents across the globe in the 20th century was a mere gust compared to the hurricane that is coming.
Previously, she had called the migrant arrivals an invasion, language that has led many to ask if her Home Office treats all migrants equally.
The UK take in far less refugees than any other country. And actually, if we look at the way that people from Ukraine fleeing for their lives have been treated, they were treated humanely. They were treated like human beings. They were welcomed and they were given safe passage.
It is all now in the hands of the Supreme Court judges. If they agree with the Court of Appeal, then the British Home Secretary's dream of sending asylum seekers to Rwanda in its current form is dead. Saeed Pereza, London.
Nigerian demonstrators who are waving Palestinian flags marched through the streets of Abuja chanting support for the people of Palestine and condemning the Israeli attacks on Gaza, where hundreds of innocent civilians have so far been killed. They expressed support for the Hamas Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, which was carried out in response to the Israeli violent attacks on Al-Aqsa. The protesters condemned the Israeli